Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, Bill. John Lord from the View My Seats podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Let me ask you, what would W.C. Hines have said about Tom Brady, the New England Patriots, and deflated footballs?
I think it would have taken him about 10 seconds to realize that it was a non-issue and that there were lots and lots of more important things to write about.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's as a younger sports writer, you know, we're influenced, I'm influenced by different people. I'm wondering how much of your career was and is influenced by W.C. Hines.
Well, like a lot of people, I had read Death of a Racehorse, and I had read Brownsville Bum, which are perhaps the two most famous and most anthologized of Bill's pieces. And I was certainly influenced by them, but I didn't meet him until 2001. I interviewed him first from long distance and then visited with him a couple of times when he was living in a house up in Vermont, up in South Dorset. And we became really very good friends. And at that point, his influence became enormous because I would send him things that I was in the process of writing, and he would scribble notes in the margins and offer suggestions and that sort of thing. So he became a significant influence on my work at that point. And then I found that he'd been a major influence on the work of lots of writers. He really delighted in encouraging people who were working in the same field.
What strikes me about his writing is that his narrative is incredibly accessible, even today. I'm wondering, how did you, as an editor, pick and choose between all of his different stories for this latest anthology?
Well, at the risk of undermining my own work, it was very easy because when Library of America called me, they told me right off they wanted to narrow the book to his nonfiction sports writing. This is a guy who was a brilliant war correspondent, wrote a great novel called The Professional and a couple of other fiction works as well, and of course wrote about lots of things other than sports. So I said to them, if you want 400 pages of his best sports writing, I can come up with a list this afternoon, just on the basis of work with which I was familiar. And that was not hard at all. And then they did some work beyond what I had done. I got a hold of Bill's scrapbooks from his daughter, Gail, and was able to find lots of columns in there worthy of publication that hadn't been anthologized before. But they went beyond that into various, magazines that have been out of print for years and years, and found some other stuff. So it really was a nice group collaboration.
The nature of long form sports writing has kind of changed throughout the years. It's W.C. Hines is kind of credited with first establishing long form sports journalism, and today it's kind of in vogue once again. I'm wondering, how do you feel, or what do you think is the place for longer form sports writing today in this day and age of blog posting and quick snippets of where everyone has a voice? Where do you find long form sports journalism today?
Well, I think the fact that some of the sources of law or some of the places where long form journalism lives now are thriving is an indication that there's an appetite for it. There's no question about that. SB Nation long form is perhaps the best example. The presided over by Glenn Stout, who has lots of experience editing Best American Sports Writing for Houghton Mifflin. I mean, that is a source of spectacularly good long-form sports journalism, some of it investigative, some of it just marvelously thorough and entertaining. And, those sites are doing rather well. So although newspapers and magazines are not what they used to be. The technology of the internet has been very good for the best of that sort of work.
So much about what Hines wrote about was kind of had to do with the sports of his era, of his generation, and you go through the list of his topics, and it seems like boxing and horse racing were a few of his few favorite things to discuss. I'm wondering, kind of getting back to what he would say, I'm wondering, you know, what he would say about the nature of those two sports today in 2015 and kind of where they went and how they could come back and what he'd be writing about today exactly.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. He did write primarily about the sports that were most prominent and most popular during his day. And boxing, I think the great attraction for him was exactly the same as the attraction that lots of other writers have found in boxing, and that is that it's a little world full of incredible characters, especially trainers. Bill often said that when it was hard to figure out what his column should be about, no problem, go over to Stillman's gym and he'd find a column. And that frequently was the case, as is very evident when you look through top of his game.
What about recording?
What he probably would say about boxing now is that it's just in many ways been eclipsed by other sports, and that it's not partly because it's not as popular as it used to be. You don't have the range of characters involved, but it's not that world has completely died. I mean, look at what boxers make on pay-per-view when they're able to scare up enthusiasm.
I wonder what he said about what he would have said about this year's Triple Crown.
I think he would have been delighted. But, you know, the interesting thing about Bill and horse racing is he could find a story, as is clear from Death of a Racehorse, he could find a story in a $1,200 claimer as easily as going to the Kentucky Derby or the Belmont Stakes. And I think that's one of the remarkable qualities of his work. He always had his eye out. He could go to a heavyweight championship fight and write about the trainer. He could go to a racetrack where there were 800 people standing around and write about one horse breaking down. He had a great eye and a great ear for stories that lots of other people might not even notice.
You mentioned how he was also a very accomplished war correspondent during World War II. Is it, I don't know where I read this, but is it true that he was one of the co-authors of MASH?
Absolutely. Yes, he and the surgeon who did his work, with the military in a MASH unit, collaborated on MASH, and the result was, I think, probably somewhat astonishing to both of them.
Yeah, I would say. How about if more people were to know that? I didn't know that, but I wonder if that would be what he might get more of his notoriety for, if more people knew that he was one of the co-creators of one of the most popular, eventually, movies and television series of all time.
Yeah, and I think probably got a big kick out of it, although there are a lot of things about Bill that probably most people, even people familiar with the best of his sports writing, don't know. He wrote a novel called The Professional, and when his publisher sent the novel down to Ernest Hemingway, Hemingway wrote a telegram back saying, it's the best novel I've ever read, set in boxing, and a damn fine first novel in its own right. And the only reason I can tell you that story firsthand is that Bill showed me the telegram.
Wow.
The telegram.
Now, Hemingway didn't go so far as to say it was better than his writing, did he?
No, I don't think so. That way, if he had, you would have known that the telegram was a fraud.
Always a modest man. As far as the...
No. Yeah, that was not one of his qualities.
Hemingway, that is.
Absolutely. Bill was quite quite modest, and As a matter of fact, it was interesting when I was doing the work to put together the collection, Top of His Game. I found lots of things that indicated that quality. At one point, he said he thought Death of a Racehorse was probably the only column he'd ever written that was worth preserving.
Huh.
And that's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, you go through the scrapbooks, and as Jeff McGregor said when he wrote the profile for Sports Illustrated of Bill Hines, he said, you go through the scrapbooks, and the incredible thing is there aren't any bad ones.
Wow.
And I think that's probably true.
For the audio version of Top of His Game, have you done, Bill, audiobooks before? And I'm wondering, you know, you have a relationship, or you had a relationship with Hines. Is it difficult to channel his voice, or was it difficult to channel his voice when you were reciting some of these classics because you were so familiar with him?
I think it would have been very difficult because I would have had a sore throat at the end if I'd really tried to channel his voice. I trusted myself to, you know, get some sort of clear and useful sense of what he had written across to people who would be listening to the audiobook, but I didn't really try to channel the sound of his voice. That would have been impossible.
I think I read this in some of the press releases regarding Top of His Game, but there were 18 pieces that were never collected or published that are in this anthology. Are those part of the audio version as well?
The audio version is much shorter. If I'd had to read the whole book, I'd still be at it. The folks at Library of America kind of went through a process of selecting what they felt was the best of the best and asked me to just read that. So most of what's in there, I think, has been published. There may be a few pieces that weren't, but all of the stuff with which people are most familiar is in there. And I think that was what their choice was.
You've talked about how Hines was just so good at finding the story, or you know, the source material just kind of came to him. I wonder how interesting it would be to place him perhaps in the Wrigley Field bleachers on Tuesday night, and it'll probably be close to freezing in Chicago then, and I wonder what he'd come up with for Game 3 of the NLCS.
Well, I don't know, but there's a part of me that says that Bill would be partial to the Cubs simply because that's the best story. The best story is the Cubs finally winning after all these years, and how the people of Chicago would respond to that, and how some of the Cubs players, with the ones who have a sense of history and all those years of the Cubs being dismissed as lovable losers, how people would respond to that. I think he would find in that a marvelous opportunity for stories. Likewise, not only in the clubhouse, but in the restaurants and the taverns of Chicago, I think he would be as good as Studs Terkel at finding stories there.
Because that's where the real action is taking place, as we know.
Well, that's where the real human voices are. I think one of the things that would be frustrating to Bill, were he still working, or were he around at this point to be working, is that there's so much insulation now between the players and the public, and for that reason, between the players and the writers. Bill used to be able to sit down next to some of these guys and say, hey, I understand you served in the Second World War. You know, I was just across that river in Germany from where you were, and I was writing about, you know, the Allied progress on those months that you were trapped in a cabin on the other side of the Rhine. This is not the kind of relationship that most writers have with athletes these days. He traveled with them. He gave them rides, you know, to training camp. He spent time sitting with boxers in their camps and in the gyms. They trusted him. They liked him. At a recent event, Rocky Graziano's daughter came up to me at a recent event we did for the book and told me how much her father had liked Bill. And you just don't find that sort of relationship so often between athletes and writers these days.
I wonder what changed. I mean, whatever changed a while ago. This is not a recent development.
Money. It's not complicated. I mean, when athletes started making so much money that they began to live in gated communities and began to be surrounded by entourages and began to be more concerned with their image and how many products they could sign up to sell on television or elsewhere, the distance between the athlete and the man on the street just got greater and greater.
Even gaining that access is nearly impossible. Gaining that trust now, you have to go through so many more people than you would have had to back in Hind's day. I'm wondering...
You have to do that, or what I've found is possible you talk to the athletes when they're very young, or you talk to the athletes when they're retired. And that's the guy, I mean, when I go to baseball fields, or when I go to major league ballparks looking for a story two and a half, three hours before the game, I'm likely to look for a coach who's been in the game for 40 years and to whom nobody else necessarily wants to speak. Because if you're trying to find the 25-game winner or the guy who's going to win the batting title, he's got canned answers and he's not going to be much of an interview because he's not going to have very much time for you.
That's a great piece of advice for young listeners listening as far as a way to develop, you know, contacts and information is to sometimes go to the periphery of the story to get the story.
Absolutely true. Find the person who's willing to talk to you. Don't necessarily go after the headliner. Find the person who's willing to talk to you and who's happy to give you a little bit of time and who gives you the opportunity to know him or her. I had a wonderful time. I have had over the years a wonderful time with pro soccer here in New England, the New England Revolution or the Boston Breakers, the women's team, because they want the publicity and
right.
They're happy to sit down with you and give you an opportunity to get to know their stories.
Okay, last one for you, Bill. We're talking to Bill Littlefield, who is talking about the audio version of the W.C. Hind's collection, Top of His Game, which he also edited. And what do you think you'll be talking about this week on Only a Game? Do you have stories in mind, or do you think those things will just come to you as they always do?
Well, some of them come unbidden toward the end of the week, and that's when it's really a little hectic. But one thing that I do know we're going to be talking about is a book called The Betrayal, a new book by Charles Fountain, who's a professor at Northeastern University, and it's a very, very interesting, compelling re-examination of the Black Sox scandal, in which he calls into question a lot of the details of that event that people have taken for granted for many years. It's almost like reading a historical novel, and I'm looking forward to that interview.
Well, the fact that the Hall of Fame won't reopen the case for Joe Jackson, or they did, but they said he can't get in, right?
Yeah, so far that's the judgment. And it's interesting because I talked to one of Jackson's relatives fairly recently, and she said, you know, it's not really fair. They gave him a lifetime ban. He served that. He's been dead for years. It's an excellent point.
True. Enough is enough. Let the man in. Bill Littlefield,
yeah,
thank
you. Exactly. What are you going to do? Keep beating him.
Bill Littlefield, thank you so much for taking the time today. Best of luck.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. Good luck to you as well.
Thank you.